出现什么暂时不能使用。请记7083888，你按照时间和你服务部联络。
Please call this message again. It's unavailable or temporarily disconnected. For inquiries, please call the customer service department at 708-3888.This is a message from AIC, your land business telephone company.
Thank you. 欢迎的预报电服务暂时不能使用，请联络亚洲电信客户服务专线7083888。お客様のイコールアクセスサービスは現在基本的に必要になっているか使えません。防災につきましては708-3888までお問い合わせください。こちらは AIC 国際電話会社です。ありがとうございました。
Thank you for listening to Off the Hook.
Good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening. Joined tonight by Kyle.
Hello.
Out in Skype land, we have Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
We have Gila.
Good evening.
And we have Alex.
You do. Good evening.
And, you know, I'm very happy that we're all here tonight. It's one of those anniversaries, you know, those anniversaries we like to kind of forget. 23 years ago tonight was 9/11, the original 9/11. Of course, I was on a Tuesday, and wouldn't you know it, our show used to be on Tuesday nights, and we almost had a show that night. What I'd like to do, just for a little while, is kind of recollect where each of us was on that auspicious occasion. For myself, I'd like to do that by playing what we played over the air 23 years ago. Not on September 11th, because the station was knocked off the air when one of the other buildings fell and knocked out the power to all of downtown. But on the 18th, the next week, we all came back, still stunned, still trying to process it all. And this is what we aired.
This is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this, what's bound to be probably one of the weirdest Tuesday nights we've had in ages, hopefully ever. And we have a lot of people here that we want to talk to, and we want to talk to you as well. We'll take some phone calls and try to get through this, and please bear with us. It's going to be difficult because what happened, what everyone across the world has been talking about for the past week without hesitation, without any kind of a break whatsoever, it happened only a couple of blocks away from where I'm sitting right now, right in this studio here. It's the weirdest sensation to know that, you know, just to know what occurred and the fact that it's not just on your TV set, it's real, it really happened. You know, it really took place. The first time heading into New York and just seeing what I was seeing on television in front of me. And that was last week. That was last Tuesday. Because, as you know, of course, this dreadful thing happened last Tuesday morning at around 8:45. And even though it was obvious that that the city was going to be completely unlike New York from that point on, certainly on that day, I felt a strange kind of drive, this obligation that the radio station was the place to be. The radio station was the place to gravitate towards. And I'm quite certain that just about everybody here at this place who has been involved with this place over the years, over the decades, and of course a lot of the listeners probably felt the same kind of spirit of this is the time to come together, this is the time to reach out, communicate, see if everybody's okay, which we're still in the process of doing. And so I headed out to New York last week, many, many hours early, because I knew it was going to be hell to get in, and it was hell to get in. Weird, because driving from Long Island, it was amazingly quiet. There was very few cars on the parkway or expressway. But almost immediately upon hitting Queens, all of a sudden, wow, it was you couldn't move. It was impossible to move forward. So I knew that the best thing to do at that point, since the subways were running on partial schedules, was to just leave my car someplace and hop on a train and just try to get into Manhattan. And it was such a weird phenomenon to see this, to see the streets of Queens. I hadn't even gotten to Manhattan yet, but in the streets of Queens, there were barricades, there were buses blocking Northern Boulevard. You know, I abandoned the parkway and the expressway and got onto some of the side streets and eventually made my way to Northern Boulevard. And for some reason, buses were blocking certain intersections, and I had to wonder why, what was going on all the way out in Queens, that certain streets had to be closed off, main streets, main arteries, and people rerouted onto side streets. But eventually I just parked my car in front of somebody's house someplace and then just got out and started walking. It was my intention to walk to the 179th Street station and get on the F train. Of course, being an idiot, I didn't realize that I parked on Northern Boulevard and not Hillside Avenue. So, of course, I didn't realize that mistake until I tried to get back many hours later and realized I was nowhere near where I thought I was. But eventually I found a bus, and I just got on the bus and took that to Flushing. Buses weren't charging at all. I just got on a bus, and they just let you on. It was the strangest feeling. And there was just a mood around the whole town that was just different. You know, it was hard to put your finger on it. People weren't, you know, openly sobbing or going hysterical in the streets, but you could feel kind of a quiet that isn't normally there in New York, and just kind of an intensity. There's kind of this look that, you know, I'm going from point A to point B, and there'll be no deviations today. I've seen that look before. I've seen that look before in documentaries about cities that are being bombed or that have been going through long civil wars and things like that, and here it is, seeing it on a bus in Queens. Eventually, I made it to the number 7 train, which actually was going to Manhattan, to Grand Central Station. Actually, was doing what the media says was impossible, getting into Manhattan. And the people on the train just didn't seem that phased. They were just reading the paper. The World Trade Center was in back, burning. You could see the smoke rising into the sky from the train outside. People are reading the paper. I was the only person standing up in the front of the train, looking in amazement. And so eventually the train got into Manhattan. I found out that's the furthest south I could get. So I had to meet up with some people, walk the rest of the way. And it was a long walk from Grand Central to Wall Street. And while there were police everywhere, there were all kinds of vehicles, all kinds of fire department and medical personnel and police everywhere, going in every direction, north, south, east, west. They're going every place, blocking streets, just by foot, running around. But still, it was not hard to get downtown. there was nobody saying you couldn't walk down the street. I think they were too busy worrying about the cars going down those streets. And so it took a long, long time, but eventually we made it all the way down here. The air was really, really thick with all kinds of debris. You had to have something covering your face or it would have been impossible to breathe. And unfortunately, by the time we got here, which was right about 8 o'clock, it was close to 8, we found out that, in fact, power had been lost to this building and a couple of others in the immediate area, and the radio station had been evacuated about an hour or 2 hours earlier. While our transmitter remained unaffected, our transmitter was broadcasting just fine, there was no audio signal to the transmitter. So basically what that amounted to was silence going over the radio, which unfortunately was the one thing that I think we needed to have more than silence, obviously, in a time like this. And we spent the rest of the night just kind of wandering around, just looking at things, looking at the reaction, I guess, just seeing all these emergency vehicles in every part of the city and seeing people, you know, strangers, friends, people that just all of a sudden meant a whole lot more, you know, and spent hours just talking and, you know, small talk or talking about the devastation or talking about anything, just being glad to be around where you could talk to these individual people. And it took a long time to get home, too, because of the aforementioned parking in the wrong part of Queens and taking 2 hours to find where I actually did park. But after that, I just kind of didn't feel like going out again for a while. I just felt like, I guess what a lot of us have been feeling over the past several days, just kind of wanting to hibernate, wanting to get away from all of this, wanting to see people and just, you know, hang out and prize the quiet times, the times with the people that you didn't realize mattered so much. And it was an eye-opener in many, many ways, because here's something that all of us were familiar with. We had all seen the Twin Towers of Manhattan. There was something we grew up with, something we became accustomed to. It was New York. And within the space of a couple of hours, they were destroyed, completely wiped off the face of the earth, and everybody inside along with them. And it made you realize how, no matter how big something is, there's nothing permanent about it. It can be wiped off the face of the earth, just like that. And at the same time, I realized that all the small things that we take for granted, they matter more than anything. And that's kind of what I've been doing over the last week. Not a whole lot of work. Not a whole lot of anything, I guess, defined in our society as productive. But a lot of seeking of comfort. I think that's what many of us in New York have been doing. And I'd certainly like to talk to people here, both in the studio and people over the phone, see how we made out, how we're going to make out in the future. I'm glad this place is still here. I'm sorry for all the time that we were off the air. I wish we could have done more.
From the Off the Hook Archives, September 18th, 2001, the week after the 9/11 attacks. And, you know, it was a very personal thing for me, very personal thing for everybody. I think those are the interesting stories. We're all very familiar with how we responded as a nation, how the world responded. But I think the more interesting stories are the individual ones, what we felt as people. And I'd like to open it up to everybody here, if you choose. And, of course, you know, something private and personal, you have every right to keep that to yourself. But if anyone wants to say where they were on September 11th, 2001, please raise your hand. Alex, I see your hand is up.
Yeah, sure. That was that was something to listen to, Emmanuel. It really was. It brought back a lot. I think I was there in studio with you when you had broadcast that. I do remember that very night, though, that we all went out to dinner on the 18th of September, one week afterwards, and we ran into our friend David, who used to be part of our crew at that point. And I remember talking with him, and I believe at the time he was working or had worked in the World Trade Center fairly recently, and he told us that his friends, he was up to, I think, 25 people that he knew that it, that he had lost at that point. It was kind of crazy to hear about it. But I was on Long Island when this happened. I remember literally I was putting my pants on to go to work. I woke up at my girlfriend's place out on Oakdale. I was putting my pants on to go to work. I had the television on. And I thought to myself, what the hell has just happened? The plane had crashed into the World Trade Center. I thought this has got to be some kind of small plane. It's got to be a small accident, you know, like a Cessna or something like that, some kind of, you know, 5 or 6 person plane, not a 747 or any kind of massive plane. There's just no way that could ever happen. And then watching this and seeing the debris fall out of the World Trade Center and seeing the people stranded up there and how big this hole was in the side of the building, you realize, like, what the hell is happening here? Something is going on. And then when the other plane hit, that was when it all came together. That was when, you know, you started to put two and two together and realize that America was under attack. It was terrifying. And I had... like I said, I was on my way to work that morning. I mean, I stayed home for a while. We watched what was happening. I was in touch with people at work. I was working at a software company at the time out on Long Island, and was also a college student. And I remember passing by Main Street in Sayville at the time and feeling like I needed to do something here. It felt very much like, you know, we were a nation under attack at that moment. You know, the Pentagon was hit, the World Trade Center was hit, you know, everything had happened at this particular time. And I stopped off at the Masonic Lodge on Main Street in Sayville, where I was a member of this lodge. I had recently become a member, and I had the keys to it because I used to mow the lawn at the lodge. I was one of the youngest people there. Everyone else was kind of aging. And I went inside, and I took out the American flag, and I hung it out so that it was out there waving on Main Street. So kind of, you know, sounds a little bit jingoistic and maybe overly patriotic at this moment, but at that time it seemed to feel really right to do that. And then I went to work, and what you said about the people in the broadcast from the 18th, about the people being on the bus and reading the newspapers, that really resonated with me, Emmanuel, because within the software company we were, there were this kind of cabal of hardcore programmers that had a deadline and wouldn't be distracted by anything. And so they just decided that they were going to just keep going. We had the television now. I was part of the IT department there. We were watching everything going. The whole place was basically in tears and crying and worried and anxious. And yet, you know, in the upper left area of this office where the programmer sat, there were just people there still trying to be hardcore and tough as if, you know, this is New York and we just get on with it. But how silly it is for them to have done that. And I hope that they look back at that particular moment and think how absolutely ridiculous it was to not pay attention to what was going on in the world, that really historical moment, to not be present with your friends and your family. Yeah, the code could always wait. So that bit and hearing that kind of resonated with me, because I will never forget just the absolute idiocy of continuing to feel like you needed to work at that time. It was not a time to work. It was a time to be together.
If I can just step in for a second, Alex, I think everybody processes in a different way. For some people, I think that might have been therapeutic. I'm not saying they were being therapeutic. Maybe they didn't care at all. I don't know. I just don't think that we can apply our own values. For instance, I'm not going to say anything about you planting an American flag or describing that as America under attack. I view it in a completely different way. We all process it very differently, and I think that's what New York was getting during that period.
Yeah. I'll buy that. Sure. We can give them the benefit of the doubt in hindsight.
Yeah, we went actually to an Afghan place. It used to be on St. Mark's. And I just remember the people... The people who are going there, going to the staff and saying, are you okay? You know, are you being hassled? Are you being threatened? That was the concern of New Yorkers for their fellow New Yorkers, wherever they happen to be from. We were all caught up in this nightmare.
Yeah, I remember that Afghan place. I do. It was excellent. Wow, that's amazing.
Khyber Pass is, it's out of business, so we can say what it was. Khyber Pass was it's a great place. Anyone else have recollections, Rob?
Yeah. At that point, I was living on Long Island, and I had the day off. I was very fortunate to not be at work when this all happened, but I had the day off, so I had stayed out late the night before, probably went out to see a movie or something, and my plan for the day was to just, whenever I wake up, as I spent a lot of my days off, I would go into the city. I would, visit folks, do some shopping, whatever, putter around, a non-specific day, just in Manhattan. The first thing that happened to me that day was my phone rang, which was next to my bed, and it was my best friend shouting at me to turn on the television. And I, like, groggily asked what channel, and she said, just turn it on. And obviously, it became apparent that what was going on was on all the channels. And my job at the time was, I was manager of an arcade in the Sunrise Mall in Massapequa. And so the first thing I had to do while waiting for, after I got a handle on what was going on, we talked a little bit. She was coming over, driving over to pick me up. While waiting for her, I checked with my colleagues. The company I worked for had locations and employees in New York City and elsewhere, and people traveling, people driving through New York. So I checked on folks, made sure that we didn't have anyone that we hadn't heard from. Everything was obviously shut down for the day. And so once I knew that things were not worse in those respects, I just took the day, and my friend and I were, had the, luxury, comparatively speaking, of just sitting at her place and watching everything go down. Her internet connection, which at the time was through AOL, sometimes worked, sometimes cut her off. The phone lines were undependable, but we were able to get on enough to sort of get the sense of, okay, people we know are accounted for, and just proceed through the day. And it's funny you mentioned the American flag thing, because I remember one thing that one of the newspapers had done, I think it was Newsday, had, I think the next day, just included a big paper American flag with every issue. And when I eventually returned to work, the mall opened back up and everything, the first thing that happened was my friend who ran the newsstand in the mall was handing these flags out to all the other store operators, and we each had them just hung up in some prominent place, because whether or not you felt all that jingoistic about it, it was something that we had to do. We had to just acknowledge in some way what had happened. And that just continued. There was a numbness. There was the following days and weeks, the realization that what was in the air, even out on Long Island, this plume coming from the site and the knowledge of what it is we were all breathing. And then to say nothing of the social repercussions that continued, watching colleagues in the mall have to be escorted to their cars by security because they looked Middle Eastern in origin, whether or not they were. The increased, everyone was on edge, on tenterhooks, and people were ready to blow up at each other. There were a couple of fights in the arcade, which was not a common occurrence, I think, before that. And yeah, there are things that I still consider a lot when, especially around this time of year. But, I think it's worth remembering. I actually was listening to Off the Hook when you made that broadcast on the 18th, whether or not it was in the arcade, because I used to put it on the speakers in the store when it was on. So whether it was there or whether it was at home, I don't remember, but I remember listening to it. And hearing your voice again, Emmanuel, was comforting. and something from before this happened that, you know, I could be assured was still going on. So, you know, belated thanks.
Thank you for that. Anyone else? Kyle? Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I've told this a bunch of times in a bunch of different ways, and I think itself, the act of recollection, it's tiresome in some ways, but it's also important to keep, I guess, sharing and retelling it in a different way. But I have a lot of different ways of thinking about it, and I'm not trying to say anything. Like you pointed out, it's up for everybody's interpretation. I don't know even if how I came to understand all of it is the right way. Like, it's just how I ended up reckoning with it personally. But it occurred at a time in my life when there was like excitement and optimism for the future. I was just starting in college, and I was sitting, basically I woke up and I'd already like kind of met people and was socializing and feel like on that kind of high of like being new and having fun and that revelry of what is, you know, being on your own for the first time. And so there's no bitterness or any kind of negative to it. And I had a lot of work ahead of me, presumably, but, so, and of course my course load reflected my interests, which was media and audio, video, all of the sorts of production stuff that I was kind of, you know, intrigued by or thought maybe I could play around with and make something of. And at the time, a lot of that stuff was changing with digital formats and stuff. So it's kind of cool to think about what my future might be in that. And so the class I was in was a mass media class for that track. And I was at in a big city in Chicago at a religious school. And I don't know. I think it... I didn't know what it was in the class, because basically I woke up and like showed up at this early class, and they just said, you know, turned on the TV and like we sat there and watched it. I just remember being in there and not knowing what it was. Like, you know how you go to a class and you don't know what the curriculum calls for that day? Is this movie day? Or like we would watch some of the like Jackson Katz and Media Foundation stuff. And so like I think, and that was where like critical theory and a lot of that stuff started making me think about like sociology and the political economy and all of that in media. And so like, are we watching some instructional or critical film of the news? But it was just us watching the news, and then that was it. I just remember not knowing what it was and the confusion of it. I think confusion might be something, a synonym for a lot of people. And I guess how to keep it short and come out of that, I just remember like an assistant or TA like handing out sheets that were describing different sources of media to look to, and that was what the professor was encouraging us to do. I remember that as a takeaway, and I think that point Alex made about hearing your voice, I was listening to the show at the time, so I was a listener, I think, and going through, I think, all the way through 2004, through the invasion even, I was listening Off the Wall started as well, and I think your interpretation of it, helping people grapple with it, was one of those sources of media, if that makes sense. Because like Pacifica or, you know, community radio in general was one of those sorts of non, how shall we say, mainstream forms of media. And that's, I guess, where I would say like today, like what it is and how we look at it. I don't really like a lot of the ways it is looked at, because to me, it completely derailed a lot of that revelry or optimism for what I had to look forward to personally and in the larger sense for America and for the world. And I feel like it completely it basically was the only thing people spoke through from then on. And then it was morphed into conflict, and it became sort of the seed of what we might say is polarized politics now and stuff. And so, like, I look at it now, and I'm kind of like, I kind of hate it for that. For me, I know that may be, like, kind of selfish a little bit, but I also look at, like, well, what did I do in light of it? And it honestly made it incredibly impossible to look at school as, like, fun. It made it impossible to think. I was already kind of tangled up and making probably just, you know, all the right mistakes for a college student. So I had a lot going against me, but I had a lot of support as well, but it was incredibly hard to think throughout that year. And I'm not a exceptional scholar in the first place, so maintaining, like, just my ultimate path was not there at that institution. I moved around a little bit. I found my own way through it all, which is, I think, a positive that I might have made of it or that came out of it, but it itself, like I said, peppered every bit of how I looked at what I would do, and it was sobering. Like, I had to really grow up quickly from that initial kind of naivete going into higher education. So it was a real rude awakening for me, and just is instructive with so many of the choices, good or bad, that I've made and the way I've thought about the world, and even my kind of skepticism about stuff today, or just like my tolerance for stuff that then I would have protested. Now I'm just like, well, it's more of like, you know, I've fought this over and over again. Like, I'm a different person now at the through the other side of it, if any of that makes sense. But I don't know. It's hard to put into words.
Well, you did it beautifully. Thank you, Gila.
So I think it's apt that I'm sharing my story last, because mine is not a New York story. Mine is not even a Chicago story. I was living on the West Coast at the time. I was a senior in college, and I was also living in a large city and going to a religiously oriented college. I was a senior, and my phone rang at 6:15, 6:30 in the morning, and I answered the phone. I should mention I'm a very sound sleeper. That is actually relevant to the story. My phone rang, and I said, who's calling me? And it was my mother, and she said, are you watching TV? And I said, no, I was asleep. And she said, you need to turn on the TV. And I said, I was sleeping. Why do I need to turn on the TV? And she said, there's been an attack, and God forgive me, I was wondering why she was telling me about something that had happened in another country. I had no idea. I could not fathom that this might be happening here. And I turned on the TV. I went down to a lounge in my dorm where everyone was standing around in their pajamas. Classes were canceled at my teeny tiny university, and we actually had an assembly so everybody could be together. And then on the 12th, classes were canceled again, and we had listening circles and talking circles. And there was something weird about being in California at the time, because everything felt so far removed, because I was on the other side of the country, and because at the time I was adamantly anti-New York City. Never wanted to live here, never wanted to spend much time here, didn't know where anything was. I had no concept of where anything was, and I knew that I had some friends who were going to school here, and I was panic contacting all my friends who were up at Columbia. Are you okay? Are you? They said, we're nowhere near this. I said, okay. But I had no idea. One thing, though, I distinctly remember from the listening circles on the 12th was saying that the thing that upset me the most, beyond the loss of life and beyond the attack itself, was this idea that we didn't know where it was coming from, at least initially, that there was no place to focus the energy and the anger and the fear. It was just out in the ether. And because everybody, for the most part, I think we can say, was feeling fear and confusion and agita, and there was no place to put it. So it just felt like everybody was very silent. And my friends and I were supposed to go see a movie. We had plans to go see a movie that night. We were supposed to go see Wet Hot American Summer, actually, which we heard about this movie. It was only playing in small theaters. We were ready. It was great. And all the movie theaters were closed. I remember a friend of mine saying she was terrified because they're going to get us next. And I said, excuse me. I understand you're scared. It's a very frightening thing that happened. I said, but people in the city where we are don't know where this school is. I don't think international terrorists are coming to find us. But that Sunday, I had to fly. I was going to Texas. I was at the airport. I was at the airport for about 3 hours, getting through security. And that day, it didn't feel like the security theater that it is now. And I didn't mind having this experience. I didn't mind that we were literally standing in line for 3 hours to go get on an airplane, because we were all trying to figure out what things were going to look like afterward. We were allowed to keep our shoes on at that point. But, and then this idea that when anything happens now, we have to clarify where it came from. It's a fascinating aftermath, I think. Last week, I was in my office, and my boss said that she got a Google alert about a flight that had been diverted. Diverted to JFK because a passenger had a health issue that turned out to be diarrhea. And she said, why does the world need to know that? And I said, it's unfortunate, and I feel for the person. I feel terrible. But the fact that it needed to be clarified that there was a health issue, but it wasn't COVID. This entire flight was not about to come down with COVID. No one was dead on the plane. No one had punched a flight attendant. It wasn't terrorism. The plane wasn't broken. This was just old-fashioned diarrhea. And the fact that whatever happens, the first thing that has to be said is, we don't think it's terrorism. A blackout. Right? It could have, whatever it is, that now that we're in this place 23 years, still 23 years later, where everything has to be, we don't think it was terrorism. We're confident it's not terrorism. I think there was some sort of fundamental shift that day where you were looking over our national shoulder in a way that we weren't before and we really have been since. And I think that's the thing that sticks with me the most.
Wow. Thank you for that. Thank you all for your recollections. You know, we're all New Yorkers in one way or another. And I think everybody listening is a New Yorker in one sense or another. We all have stories, and I encourage people to reach out to each other. Listen to the stories. There is nobody who is not touched by this, of course, if you weren't born yet, obviously. But the people who were around then and sentient, they all have different perspectives, different ways of looking at this traumatic and historic event that took place 23 years. I can't believe it's 23 years ago tonight. We've done two other shows on September 11th. We were supposed to do one on September 11, 2001, but the station was off the air. So this is the third time we've done that, and I think it's the most thoroughly we've thought back on it. I'd like to give listeners the opportunity as well on Overtime, which follows this program on YouTube. You can call up and tell us your recollections. Starting at 8 o'clock, I'm going to do something unusual. I'm going to give out the phone number on this show, which we don't usually do. And the phone right now is off the hook in case there's any wiseacres out there that want to call now. The phone number, write it down and call us after 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. It's 802-321-4225. That's 802-321-HACK is what that spells. If you have a story to tell, please keep it short. And, not too short, but keep in mind there's probably a lot of people that want to call in as well. Yes, Alex, go ahead. Alex, once again, you're muted.
Really? Ay, ay, ay. All right, you know what?
What? talk to us.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah. Your mouth was moving and nothing was coming out, so I assumed you were muted.
That's probably faded a bit now, though. Are the levels worse now?
For God's sake, Alex, tell us what you want to say.
Yeah. One of the things that always stuck out to me was I think about this every year, too, was that the New Yorker, Halloween edition of the New Yorker, and you know how they have different covers every week that were always fascinating, the Halloween edition of the New Yorker in 2001, and I think about it and I choke up every time, because you remember that, it was a totally different world back then when September 11th happened, and our policemen and our firemen were our heroes back then. I mean, these were the people that were going down into the rubble and removing bodies and looking for survivors and the police dogs. And you remember seeing the images of these firemen coming back entirely covered in soot. You know, the only portion of them not covered in soot was under their eyes from the tears. And, you know, it was an incredibly moving thing. And this cover of the New Yorker has a scene of kids either in Brooklyn or it looks like the West Village. They're in front of some brownstones or something like this, obviously a New York scene. And every single kid is dressed up as a policeman or a fireman in that Halloween cover. And it's really moving to look at it and think back at it, that time.
I remember the season premiere of Saturday Night Live back then, where the firemen were on stage. And in fact, Giuliani was even there. That was back when people thought Giuliani was capable of doing some good. And I even praised him on the air of this station, which is something that, believe me, is a one-offer. He at the time seemed to be a comforting figure, you know, America's mayor, I think he was called. But I remember he was there at the opening of SNL, and one of the cast members asked him, "So can we be funny now?" And he said, "Sure, try something new." Which, you know, it's the laugh we needed back then. Enough recollection, I guess. We have to look forward. One thing I just want to conclude with. I remember, I don't know if it was on this station or another show or just a private conversation, but I remember it being brought up that this horrible event was also a tremendous opportunity for the world to come together and unite against evil, against injustice, to make sure something like this never happened again. And boy, did we blow that. Boy, did we make it as bad as we possibly could make it. TSA, Patriot Act, all kinds of military actions, countless lives lost for no good reason. But that's how things go sometimes. All right, we have only a few minutes left, but we should talk about some other things that are happening. We spent a lot of last week talking about Elon Musk and what has become of Twitter and his war with Brazil, which I think is still ongoing. I haven't really heard much about it. Haven't really been paying much attention to anything he says, with one exception. Last night, you might recall, there was another event where every channel was broadcasting something. It was an ass whooping from Pennsylvania. Apparently, Elon Musk is once again getting called out, and this is really disgusting, creepy. A comment he made to Taylor Swift after she publicly endorsed Kamala Harris for president. He took to Twitter and said, "Fine, Taylor, you win. I will give you a child and guard your cats with my life." I mean, how inappropriate, how creepy can you possibly get? And this guy is running a major platform, sending people to space. It disturbs me. It disturbs me so much. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to report this account right now, if I can figure out how to do it on Twitter, report Elon Musk to Twitter as being inappropriate. You all can tell me not to.
Oh, I say go for it. Let's see what happens there. Yeah. So, that's just a bizarre story. I did not know that, Emmanuel. I don't think there has been any developments on the Brazilian front either.
Okay, I'm reporting the Post. It asked what type of issue am I reporting? Hate, abuse and harassment, violent speech, child safety, privacy, spam, suicide or self-harm, sensitive or disturbing media, impersonation, or violent and hateful entities. And I think I can only choose one of those. I'm going to go for abuse and harassment. Does everybody agree that's the right one?
I think that's fair. Emmanuel, are you still... Do you still have a Twitter account?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Do you still use it?
How else do I harass my various elected officials?
I will be curious to see what happens after you submit this report.
Well, let's see. Okay, so under abuse and harassment now, I have some choices of the best match. Unwanted NSFW and graphic content. NSFW, not safe for work. Targeted harassment. I think that's kind of the lead right now. Insults, unwanted sexual content, and graphic objectification. I'll go for that one. Violent event denial or inciting harassment. I think the unwanted sexual content is definitely the one to choose there. And I'm submitting. Thanks for helping make X better for everyone. I have reported Elon Musk's post. Not Elon Musk, the account. I'll do that next, but the post. I feel good. I feel good about this. Everybody should do the same thing. Of course, that means tracking down his horrible post in the first place. But sometimes you have to get a little bit dirty to get justice. One other thing, and I think we'll talk about this on overtime because we're kind of out of time now, but there was a fascinating story last week about a U.S. media company that turns out is alleged to have been funded by Russia, linked to some right-wing social media stars, and it's the company is known as Tenet Media. You guys hear about this story? It's really kind of disturbing.
It's fascinating.
Yeah.
Yes. Emphatically yes. This is a kind of thing I think we all are kind of we should be sensitive to, be aware of when you're endorsing things and doing things for cash. You should investigate and find out about the ownership, especially if there are fictitious benefactors or people that are sponsoring it. But the people who were accused of this alleged thing are feigning ignorance.
I just found their names. I was searching for the names in the whole story. Benny Johnson, Tim Pool, and Dave Rubin. Tim Pool, by the way, has been on this show many years ago. I'm sorry, I fell for what he was saying. Seemed like he was fair-minded at the time. Maybe he was. Maybe he was. He hadn't completely bought into right-wing propaganda. But the signs were there. The signs were there, just like the signs with Elon Musk were there before he went totally wacko. But in this particular case, as Kyle said, yeah, they're claiming they're the victims, that they didn't know. They were getting, how much money per video
Well, there are different arrangements. One,
$100,000
host. There was others that were a sort of salaried situation where there was like $400,000 a month or something. There was different criteria.
And they didn't ask where the money was coming from.
In some cases, they asked a little bit. Others, there weren't any questions asked, and they were to basically keep doing what they're doing. And that's the way this kind of thing is done. You have people that are already sort of useful, and you just want to make them more useful to you. And it is in the interest of state actors and large entities on the global stage that will want to amplify that because it benefits their strategic interests. So I think that a lot of what we have noticed in hacking over the years is that there are shells of shells in the darker parts of the web, and you need to understand that. And I think that's something we talk about when we're educating people that are new. They need to know that they could quickly become affiliated with something that is connected to these types of things in ways they might not understand.
We're going to have to continue this conversation on overtime as we are out of time now. Please support WBAI. Give to WBAI.org. Give the number to WBAI.org. Write to us, OTH@2600.com. Tune into Off the Hook next Wednesday, 7 p.m. And overtime coming up at 8 o'clock on YouTube. Follow the link on 2600.com, the main page, and we will see you there. Give us a call and tell us your stories from 9/11 if you have any. We will we'll see you next time. Stay free.
You are somebody that I don't know, but you're taking shots at me like it's Patron, and I'm just like, damn. It's 7 a.m. In the street, that's a knockout. But you say it in a tweet, that's a cop out. And I'm just like, hey, are you okay? And I ain't trying to mess with your self-expression, but I've learned a lesson that's stressing and obsessing about somebody else with no fun. And snakes and thumbs never broke my bones. So we figured you out.